ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Wednesday, the 26th of November. I'm Sabra Lane in Canberra, coming to you from Ngunnawal country and acknowledging other custodians. The United States President has used the annual turkey pardoning ceremony at the White House to reveal his administration is very close to a Ukraine-Russia peace deal. The tempo towards an agreement has picked up after Mr. Trump blindsided Kyiv with a 28-point plan last Friday, sparking frantic negotiations and a slimmed-down deal that both the US and Ukraine largely agree to. But there are growing doubts that Russia will accept any revisions that benefit Ukraine. Reporter Cyan Valence is in London. Cyan, where are negotiations at?
Well, they're changing by the minute at this stage. There are meetings left, right and centre. Of course, the main meetings happened over the weekend in Geneva between the US and Ukraine. And that was when they started quite coldly. They did not agree on this 28-point peace plan that President Trump presented to Ukraine. But they ended quite warmly. And now today, President Trump has said that he feels they're getting very close to a deal. And President Zelensky has said he wants to move forward. But there are still some aspects that need to be worked out. And he wants to talk about some of the specific details, some of the more contentious issues like territory with Donald Trump. And the Ukrainians are really pushing for President Volodymyr Zelensky to head over to America by the end of November, which is, of course, the end of the week, to discuss those in person. There hasn't been any word whether that will happen. Of course, it is going to be Thanksgiving over there in the next few days, so holiday season, very busy. But this really has picked up pace over the last few days. And of course, there are also meetings between the US and Russian representatives in Abu Dhabi. They're not revealing what's happening in those negotiations. We understand that Russia did like the original 28-point plan, which Ukraine and many of its allies said favoured Russia too much. And it's understood they're not happy about any revisions, particularly if the Europeans have too much to say about them. So at the moment, we're hearing from many different people who have a lot of vested interest in these talks, but we know that the US and Ukraine are happy to move forward. As to whether Russia will accept a revised plan, that's still not known at this point.
So, Anne, Ukraine's allies in the so-called Coalition of the Willing have also met today. What did they discuss?
Well, they've doubled down on their support of Ukraine, particularly on putting troops actually in when this ceasefire comes into place. So the UK, France and Turkey have said as soon as there's a ceasefire, there'll be boots on the ground from their nations. That's something that Russia doesn't want to see. So that's another point of contention. But this was something that the leaders of the Coalition of the Willing, which was Keir Starmer, the UK Prime Minister and the French President Emmanuel Macron, they led the meeting today and they were really pushing for everyone involved in the Coalition of the Willing. There are now 36 allies of Ukraine who are in this coalition, really urging them to put their money and their troops where their mouth is. Here's how UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer opened the meeting.
And I urge colleagues on the call this afternoon to firm up their national commitments, because we need to ensure we've got the most robust capability. And it's only if Russia believes we're serious to responding to any violation that this will underpin a lasting peace. And again, it's great that the US have made progress on drafting this in recent days.
That's the British Prime Minister Sir Keir Starmer, and before him our reporter Cyan Valence in London. Heavy rains have lashed Israel, the West Bank and Gaza, causing serious flooding in many of the tent communities across the war-ravaged strip. The weather's increasing the suffering for hundreds of thousands of Palestinians left homeless as a result of the war, with fears the crisis will only get worse as winter takes hold. Middle East correspondent Matthew Doran reports.
A dangerous deluge falls on tarps, tents and dirt. This is the second major downpour in as many weeks, inundating the camps which have sprung up across Gaza amidst the rubble of 2 years of war.
All the household goods are gone. Nothing is left. Even the flour, the sacks of flour, the sacks of food, they are full of water.
41-year-old Nuha Dinna is living in a tent in the Nakheel camp in Deir al-Bala, central Gaza. The thin mattresses her family lie on are sodden and floating in the floodwaters. She's piled them as best she can to try to keep at least some of them dry.
I don't know where we'll sleep tonight. We need to find a place outside the camp.
In the camp where Nuha is living, the water is at about ankle height. But elsewhere in Gaza, Palestinian authorities say flooding reached 40 to 50 centimetres. Another resident, Mohammed Atallah, pointed to people trying to make sandbags to stop the water.
Can you see how the children and women are carrying sand to put in the tents? But it's all in vain.
Humanitarian agencies have repeatedly warned of the dangers of the looming winter in Gaza, saying nowhere near enough tents, tarpaulins and other shelter supplies are making it into the strip. Israel disputes that, insisting it is letting aid in. COGAT, the agency responsible for aid coordination in Gaza, says it has allowed more than 250,000 tarpaulins into Gaza in recent times and 11,000 tents in the last week. It says more deliveries will continue to enter Gaza throughout the winter. Another displaced Palestinian, Jalal Ayad, says the situation is dire.
All these tents are torn and the water is everywhere inside the tents, and all the belongings in the tents have been inundated.
And this is just late November. The worst of the winter conditions are yet to come. This is Matthew Doran in Jerusalem, reporting for AM.
The federal government is setting up an Artificial Intelligence Safety Institute to assess emerging capabilities and assess the risks of the technology. Senator Tim Ayres, the Federal Industry, Innovation and Science Minister, will have oversight of it, and he joined me a short time ago. Minister, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Saba. Really good to be here in the studio in Canberra with you.
You've said that this institute will be up and running by early 2026. How much will it cost? How many people will be working for it? And where will it be headquartered?
Well, we'll have more to say as part of the usual budget and my FO processes about how this is funded. But it will be in the heart of government, here in Canberra, working in my department to perform this important function on behalf of government and on behalf of the Australian people, to make sure that we're taking every step to keep Australians safe as this new technology unfolds and evolves across Australia's landscape, in our workplaces, in our homes and in our communities.
The previous minister, Ed Husic, conducted a 12-month consultation period with industry over specific laws. In January this year, he said that the government was in the final stages of developing mandatory guidelines. What's happened to that?
Well, I'm building on the work that was done in the last term by Ed and the team. The Safety Institute is an important component of the government's approach here. I gave a commitment early in this term that we would deliver an artificial intelligence plan for Australia by the end of this year. There's a few Christmas decorations in the studio on the way in, Sabra. The end of the year is not that far away. But I did want to, this week, use the opportunity to sketch out for Australians what the Safety Institute would deliver in terms of its capability. We signed up to an Artificial Intelligence Safety Institute in 2024 in Seoul with a group of other like-minded countries, because it's important that we establish a network of these capabilities around the world with like-minded economies to make sure that we're getting the best research, the best awareness of the possibilities that the technology offers us. And we should never lose sight of that, but also making sure that governments are working together and working in the community to lift capability and make sure we're keeping Australians safe.
CSIRO comes under your portfolio as well. The combined job cuts under Labor are now 1,110 versus 1,150 under Tony Abbott. The government says it's serious about a future made in Australia, but it's really taken the science community by surprise. What does this say about Labor's commitment to science in the modern economy?
There are no funding cuts to the CSIRO. That is the most important point.
Jobs are gone.
Come to those jobs in a moment, but no funding cuts. The CSIRO is funded by the federal government to the tune of around $1 billion every year. It's a really important commitment to our premier national science institution. What's going on in the CSIRO is after 15 years of not doing a systemic review of the CSIRO's programs of research, this management and this board are getting on with that work to make sure that all the programs of research match very closely the federal government's national science priorities. That's the work that's going on here. We have funded the CSIRO fully. We continue to do that. There are no funding cuts and none anticipated.
But those jobs are going. This will all sound a bit harsh to those people who are losing their jobs.
The CSIRO has been going through a very thorough internal consultation process, not just this week and last week, over the last few months to work with the science community and the science and research workers who work inside the CSIRO, like terrific people who do amazing research every day of the week, to make sure that those programs of research match the government science priorities and that every science dollar is spent firmly in the national interest. That's what Australians would expect. There's a series of decisions that'll be worked through here. They are tough decisions, but I just stress to you, Sabra, no funding cuts to the CSIRO, around about $1 billion every year, and I will keep working with them as the minister to make sure that this vital national science agency is operating in the national interest, that it's fully capable and it's fit for purpose for future generations.
You've got busy times at the moment. You've also got the Tomago aluminium smelter happening in your patch as well. It's understood that the federal government could be planning to underwrite the site by investing billions of dollars in taxpayer support through the Snowy Hydro Energy Company to provide cheap energy to the smelter. Is that about right?
Well, we're working very hard. I said at the beginning of this process that we would leave no stone unturned. I won't confirm details with you, not because I'm trying to avoid the discussion, but we're in the heart of months and months and months of detailed discussions about this important aluminium facility. It's important to the Hunter Valley. It's important to Australia as well.
Many people, though, will be a bit anxious. Like, if we're going to underwrite this, is it going to be a time-limited thing? Will it be 2 years, 5 years, 10 years?
Well, all of those considerations. Like, what's required here is the company itself, of course, investing in the future capability of the plant, a clear pathway through for the two governments and the company to work together to secure the future of the facility. I've been going to this facility for years and years and years. I know it well. It's a vital facility. We'll keep working at it.
You're hoping to have something before Christmas?
Well, of course, I'd like to see security for this facility today. But the nature of these things, Sabra, is if you're serious about it, you keep working at it hard with your colleagues, with the New South Wales government, with the owners of the Tomago facility, and we will, as I said, leave no stone unturned to work through these issues because it's important for workers, it's important for the Hunter Valley, and it's important for Australia.
Minister, thanks for joining AM this morning.
Thanks, Sabra.
The Federal Minister for Industry, Innovation and Science, Tim Ayres. Australia is making progress on financial gender equality. It's at a record high. The Financi Women's Index recorded a drop in female underemployment and a narrowing of the superannuation gap. But it's highlighting concerns in other areas like female representation on boards and childcare. Isabel Misali reports.
Bianca Harchi-Hazelman believes progress on gender financial equality shouldn't be taken for granted. She's the CEO of Financi, a firm that advocates in this space, analysing Australian government and industry data.
It's almost like a two steps forward, one step back progress march for gender equity. But certainly the long-term trend has been pushing towards high. I'm excited by this progress because we're just about to tip over that 80% mark.
That marks a record high for the Financi Women's Index, which rose by 0.12 points in the September quarter.
And what's helped that is this improvement in the underemployment rate. And we've also had this narrowing of the gender gap in superannuation, which is excellent news. And that's, of course, correlated to improved earnings and also improved superannuation savings, contributions and increased participation among women in the workplace.
AMP Chief Economist Shane Oliver also welcomes a narrowing in the superannuation gap. He's on the advisory committee for the Women's Index.
More broadly, it is just a sign that we are seeing an improvement in financial equality between men and women, and superannuation has traditionally been an area which has lagged quite substantially.
But he's worried about female representation levels on ASX 200 boards. That figure hasn't improved for two consecutive quarters, remaining at just above 38%. Dr. Ashley McGrath is the Chief Executive of CEOs for Gender Equity, a WA-based organisation that supports leaders to take action.
Obviously, we never like to see progress stalled in this area, but, you know, critical mass, according to research and kind of practice, is, you know, between that kind of 30 to 40%. So I'm not overly concerned about that. Obviously, we'd like to see it, you know, closer to the 50% mark, but it's close to 40%, which is what we advocate for as a minimum.
Elsewhere in the Women's Index, concerns have been raised over a recent lack of confidence in the childcare system. Financiers Bianca Hachi-Hazelman explains that impacts predominantly women's employment if they don't feel their children are in quality care.
Where those charges were laid in Melbourne West, one of the most horrendous cases of abuse, there was a definite pullback in female workplace participation relative to male. And at the same time, we've also seen this pullback in the number of children enrolled at childcare centres.
She hopes quick reforms in the childcare sector will make confidence return.
Isabel Masali reporting. Fraudsters and intermediaries claiming to have access to Indonesian immigration officials have been scamming workers eager to come to Australia. Each year, 5,000 work and holiday visas are issued, but applicants first need an Indonesian referral letter to get a visa. Getting one of those is extremely difficult. They're supposed to be free, but scammers are charging thousands. Natasha Salim reports.
Agus, not his real name, worked for 7 years in Indonesia to earn enough money to apply for an Australian work and holiday visa.
I studied while working in a restaurant as a barista. I had to save up for years. The wage is low in Indonesia, while I have to support my family financially.
He first needed a referral letter from the Indonesian Directorate General of Immigration, known as SDUWHV. It's free, but so popular that getting one is known locally as the war. And when online applications opened, the system crashed and Agus couldn't get through.
I felt lost for not being able to get the work and holiday visa.
There appeared to be another way. He was contacted by someone who said they had connections with the immigration department and could source a referral for $5,500. For many Indonesians, that could be close to their annual salary.
He asked for 60 million rupiah, but I told him I don't have that much money.
When contacted by the ABC, the middleman says he only offers moral support and encouragement and knows nothing about asking for payments for referrals. Agus says the process needs an overhaul.
I feel betrayed by my own country. The immigration office has killed thousands of young people's dreams of working in Australia.
Indonesia's Ministry of Immigration told the ABC that any agents or institutions offering SDUWHV war services should be reported. Linda, not her real name, paid a middleman $2,000 for an SDUWHV only to be told by the Australian Home Affairs Department that she was unsuccessful because she had given a bogus document.
I got scared, confused, and didn't know what to do.
She wanted to apply for a visa again, but was told by the Australian officials that her application might be rejected and was verbally abused by the scammer when she confronted them. Some Indonesian MPs have called on the Australian embassy to handle the process from start to finish, scrapping the need for a referral letter. However, ANU migration expert Alan Gamlin can understand why Australia still has this extra step for Indonesian visa applications.
A country like Indonesia has far more people wanting to gain access to Australia's labour market than could fit through the quota of the working holiday visa scheme. And so in many ways, it's very helpful for the Indonesian government to do that pre-screening stage of applications so that the Australian visa system doesn't get overwhelmed.
In a statement, an Australian Home Affairs Department spokesman says the government monitors work holiday maker activity to assess whether any changes to process would be appropriate for partner countries, including Indonesia.
Natasha Salim reporting there. And that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Living in Australia, we're all pretty invested in the weather. So when the Bureau of Meteorology, yes, the bomb, changed its website, almost everyone had a view about it. And that was before we realised, they'd forgotten to tell us, it cost close to $100 million to build it. Today, the ABC's lead rural reporter in Victoria, Justine Longmore, on the website debacle. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.